ancient Hawaiian sport of surfing can be traced back as far as 1,000 years ago, as men, women, children, and even Hawaii's great king Kamehameha enjoyed the thrill of riding waves. In the earliest description of the sport by a visiting European, Captain James Cook observed upon watching an Hawaiian surf rider in the year of 1777.
I could not help concluding that this man felt the most supreme pleasure while he was being driven on so fast and so smoothly by the sea.
Then in the 1800s, the waves fell flat with the arrival of the Calvinist missionaries. Shocked and outraged by the state of undress and the easy mixing of the sexes that surfing fostered, the missionaries banned the sport. The extinct Polynesian pastime was then reintroduced in the early 20th century by Alexander Hume Ford, a globe-trotting promoter who set about reviving island tourism by romanticizing surfing at Waikiki. In 1912 came surfing's first international icon, Waikiki beach boy and celebrated Olympic swimming champion, Duke Kahanamoku, the only surfer to ever appear on a U.S. stamp. While traveling the globe giving swimming demonstrations, Duke became surfing's Johnny Appleseed, introducing his favorite sport to far-flung places like California, New York, and Australia. One of the fans enthralled by the Duke was a young Wisconsin swimming champion named Tom Blake. Relocating to Hawaii, Blake would go on to become one of the 20th century's most influential surfers through his innovative surfboard design, but most importantly, through his advocacy of surfing as a way of life.
By 1948, surfing had taken root along the California coast, where a skinny, 10-year-old kid from Hermosa Beach named Greg Knoll found himself immersed in the emerging subculture. Following in the footsteps of pioneers like Pete Peterson and Lauren Harrison, Knoll eagerly joined the ranks of these eccentric sportsmen, carving out an entirely new and free-spirited lifestyle.
Those guys were all kind of gentlemanly. It was a different era, a different time. Something went to hell in the early 50s. It's like somebody threw a light switch. When the advent of the lightweight longboard came in, something happened.
Hey, man. I don't feel like going to school no more. Me neither.
It was the introduction of lightweight balsa wood and the newly discovered aerospace material, fiberglass, that suddenly cut the weight of surfboards in half and paved the way for a younger generation to begin picking up the offbeat sport.
There was this great feeling of individuality and freedom from being able to ride this wave, and it made us feel free and I think maybe almost rebellious.
The ride itself is such a bitchin' deal, so rewarding. It becomes so important to you that it becomes the object around which you plan the rest of your life. And everyone else is planning their life around money and acquisition of money.
And all of a sudden, a bunch of guys come along and they go, screw the money, you know, I'm having all the fun I could possibly have. Girls are loving it, you know, because here we are a bunch of scroungy surfers. The shittier you dress and the funnier language you talk, which nobody understood half the stuff we were saying because it was all surf jargon, the more fun we were having, the more it would piss off society.
With the devotion to riding waves came the creation of a new lifestyle centered around all things beach. This emerging lifestyle ran in direct opposition to mainstream values. The surfers were often regarded as nothing more than beach bums.
My parents never saw me surf. They thought it was a disease. You know, they couldn't come to the game. They couldn't see the score up on the board, you know, and couldn't understand what good it did.
Greg Knoll talks about his principal calling him into the office and saying, what are you guys doing down there on the beach? What exactly are you doing? Not just riding, not just going out to surf, but what are you doing on the beach?
For the first time ever, they had a group of guys that didn't give a rat's ass dropping out of the basketball team and the football team and just giving the whole thing the finger and going, oh, I don't give a shit about that. I want to go surfing.
For this new generation of surfers, surfing wasn't just something you did, but something you became. Not just a sport, but a statement.
I think getting radical was part of the culture at that time. After a while, it was expected of us, and therefore we fulfilled those expectations.
Some guy's dad had gotten back from the war, and he had a closet full of Nazi stuff that he brought back. And then they went over and took flexies and rode down a storm drain for a mile underneath the town of Windensea. And that was just, you know, having a good time, but people see it and they go, whoa, what's this all about?
That kind of behavior was not mean-spirited, it was playful. It was like turning a hearse into a surfmobile. Instead of dead bodies, it was all about living life to the fullest.
Amidst the mirth and mayhem of the fledgling surf scenes, from Windensea to San Onofre to Malibu, much homage was given to the sport's Polynesian roots, with grass shacks, floral aloha shirts, and the playing of ukuleles. But on a winter morning in 1953, another Hawaiian import landed like a bomb on the front porch of California.
I can remember I was a 14-year-old paperboy delivering papers in Santa Monica. It was the Evening Outlook. And I got to work that afternoon. I looked at the front page, and there was Buzzy Trent, George Downey, and Wally Forsythe coming down the face of what looked like a 30-foot wave.
This simple image sent shockwaves through California's emerging surf culture, triggering the first migration of West Coast surfers to the Hawaiian Islands and Oahu's Makaha Beach.
Wind and wave and sand and sunshine.
It was Makaha's combination of smooth, crystal blue warm water and large, gently tapered waves that helped create surfing's first accessible big wave riding paradise.
At Makaha, if we had 10 guys on a good day, that was a lot. You knew every one of them. They were there every time.
To us, that was a crowd at that time.
You would be out there for maybe about 2-3 hours, and you would only catch like 5 waves, you know, because you don't want to mess up. You don't have no leash, and you were out there. And when you get wiped out, there's nobody.
In the early days, we lived on the beach. We had tents. Then later on, we all got together and rent a Quonset hut for 25 or up to 50 bucks, and 10 guys would be in the Quonset hut. You know, so it was cheap. And then that was an upgrade. It was easy going, no problems, no hassles. You know, we used to leave our board on the beach there, go into Waikiki for 2 days, come back, it'd still be there, nobody would touch it.
The young Californians were mentored by Makaha's first generation of big wave riders. Surfers like Woody Brown, along with Wally Froiseth, George Downing, and Buzzy Trent, had spent much of the previous decade challenging Makaha's giant surf.
They were the astronauts of their era. They were conquering big waves that no one had conquered before them.
You know, to me, those guys were bigger than life before I went over there.
That trio of guys were the first really hardcore big wave riders that set the blueprint for the next generation.
But it was 23-year-old George Downing who carved the mold from which all other big wave riders were cast.
I think that George Downing, in a sense, is truly the original big wave surfer.
Downing designed and built the first true big wave surfboard and was instrumental in exploring many of Oahu's other big wave breaks.
they all wanted to ride more big waves, and Mekaha doesn't get big that often.
And we had heard these fabulous tales about, you know, this deep, dark, foreboding place called the North Shore.
15 miles up the coast from Mekaha was the North Shore, a remote 13-mile stretch of coastline backed up against a patchwork of pineapple fields and taro farms.
I can remember coming out of the pineapple fields at Schofield and getting my first glimpse of the North Shore. Here's this magical place laid out in front of you.
Suddenly they get to a place where all those dreams live.
Every time you go another couple hundred yards, shit, here's another place. Look at this.
At first we didn't have a clue that we had stumbled on something so fabulously magical and powerful.
Just taking the waves into consideration, they must have thought that they'd found nirvana.
The discovery of the North Shore was surfing's equivalent of Columbus reaching the New World. Nowhere else on Earth would there be found so many world-class big wave breaks in such close proximity.
What the Paris runways are to fashion is what the North Shore is to the world of surfing.
We're among the first groups of Californians to live out there and just dedicate themselves to surfing.
Spending 8-10 hours a day in the water doing nothing but surfing our guts out.
There wasn't any home life, so, you know, we spent our days on the beach. I mean, that's what we did. We surfed all day, every day, no matter what.
In those days, we never saw girls. And if you brought a date out and sat her in the car while you surfed for 4 or 5 hours, you never had that date again.
These guys came to surf. I mean, and it was kind of unheard of. You don't have a job. You're going to come spend a couple months here to surf.
No watch, no money, no car, no nothing. Just shorts and a t-shirt. There were no hotels. There was one place in Haleiwa that was this set of cubicles. And
you'd have guys sharing the place and getting mattresses from the Salvation Army and throw them in on the floor. And I mean, it was a scene to try to make ends meet.
There wasn't a lot of money, you know, so if we wanted to eat, we had to go diving.
We'd dive every day and get fish and lobster and turtle in those days.
You know, they would go pick coconuts and papayas and they'd go fish, and in those days, you could live off the land.
Guys would come over from the mainland, they'd patch our surfboards for us for a peanut butter sandwich.
Pat Kern and I, we'd get in a little bit of trouble, we'd steal chickens or something like that. I mean, the whole thing was waiting for waves.
You know, we would do anything to amuse ourselves and each other. So somewhere I had learned about how to put lighter fluid in your mouth and torch it off. And actually, I did set the side of that house on fire.
They're just spending their days living in the sun and living a life that's not the 50s men in the gray flannel suit thing. It's like an alternative thing the way Kerouac was and bikers were, except they're having fun.
That was the counterculture of its day. You know, you were bucking the system and you went to Hawaii and you rode waves. They were the pioneers, not only of riding big waves, but of the culture of surfing. They're the ones that set the pace, this kind of free and easy lifestyle.
That really was a unique period in history. They were doing something so unique in the 20th century. And the fact was, there was a handful of them. It wasn't like jazz, where there was the Chicago scene and the New York scene. This was it, that tiny little epicenter. Those 24 intrepid men and the women that went with them, living that life. And it only lasted a few years. What a remarkable time that must have been.
Thank you.
these surfers rode more and more of the North Shore's fantastic waves, the biggest wave of all still eluded them. The spot? Waimea Bay, which began to break when the rest of the North Shore was too big to surf. But Waimea Bay was riddled with taboos and fears, as surfers of the 50s were haunted by the memory of Dickie Cross, a young California surfer who in December of 1943 became trapped by a fast-rising storm swell while surfing Sunset Beach. Unable to reach the shore, he and fellow surfer Woody Brown elected to paddle 3 miles south to the safer, deep-water Waimea Bay. But 50-foot waves were closing out the bay, and while attempting to reach the shore, both were caught by mountains of whitewater and ripped from their boards. Brown eventually washed up on shore naked, while 17-year-old Cross was never seen again.
I mean, it spooked everybody. They were like, you can't ride there. That's it's a killer. You know, we're not going to go out there. You're going to die.
Along with the death of Dickie Cross, Waimea's reputation was steeped in superstition and dread, with tales that ranged from haunted houses on the point to human sacrifices at the Heiau, or Hawaiian burial ground overlooking the bay.
All of these things were whizzing around this place like a bunch of ghouls, and people really believed that if you paddled out, there was going to be this goddamn vortex and be like flushing the toilet, and there go the Howleys for the season.
People thought you couldn't ride Waimea Bay. They watched it, they looked at it, and they said, can't be done.
You know, you'd look at Waimea and you'd wonder, can the human body survive the wipeout?
But the lure of riding Waimea was unrelenting, as during each big swell, surfers would find themselves standing spellbound on the shore, transfixed by the sight of these huge, perfectly shaped waves exploding off the point.
We'd go by there when it was breaking, and you're going, geez, that looks like a rideable wave.
You could see that this had all the potential of being a great surf spot, and at some point, you just had to go, to hell with it. We can do this thing.
On a fall day in October of 1957, a handful of surfers converged on Waimea as a 20-foot swell began lighting up the bay. Sitting on the point watching the huge empty waves with his buddy Mike Stang, 19-year-old Greg Knoll had finally seen enough. He unstrapped his board and with Mike Stang in tow, walked down to the water's edge. Moments later, they were joined by fellow surfers Pat Curran, Mickey Munoz, Del Cannon, Fred Van Dyke, Harry Church, Bing Copeland, and Bob Bermel, who together with Nolan Stang paddled out to attempt the impossible.
It was obvious where the waves were breaking, and we'd all had enough experience so that, you know, you knew pretty much where to paddle to.
I remember paddling into the lineup, you know, and your balls were just in your stomach, you know, thinking that the bottom was going to fall out and something was going to eat you alive.
I'm thinking to myself, I don't want to get wiped out because I know there's sharks here, and I'm not into swimming with sharks, exactly.
We got out there, it was a big surprise. It's, it's not an easy takeoff.
I took off on a wave and went down the side and popped out the other end and went, shit, I'm still alive, nothing's happened.
After we got a couple of waves, that kind of took, hey, we can do this,
They broke the taboo, they went out and did it. And once it was done, opened up the floodgates, and it's like, okay, now how far do we take it?
The following year of 1958, Waimea Bay blew big wave surfing wide open, as another migration of ambitious surfers came charging onto Hawaii's North Shore to campaign the huge surf. These surfers were out to ride the biggest swells nature could produce, so they built what came to be known as guns, long, narrow surfboards designed exclusively for catching the fast-moving 25-foot waves of Waimea.
I rode an 11-6. It was, first and foremost, a wave-catching machine. Because if you can't catch a wave, nothing else matters.
Unlike the somewhat easy takeoff of a Kaha, Waimea was a fear-inducing 25-foot elevator drop, sometimes requiring more faith than skill.
It almost doesn't help sometimes to know what you're doing out there, because if you know too much, it intimidates you.
I mean, everything is moving. Everything is in flux. Nothing is constant. It's so dynamic that you can't pre-plan it.
Not only are you riding down this mountain, but this mountain is chasing you, and you have to use all your skill and all your ability to get away from this mountain, but at the same time, use it to your own benefit.
When you come down the face of a mountain, you're on fire. Your heart is exploding. Endorphins are just busting out in your brain. And you want to not just prove that you can do it, but discover what you're made out of.
Apart from the challenge of learning to ride Waimea, was the even greater challenge of surviving the horrifying wipeouts.
You feel like a piece of lint in a washing machine, because the force of nature that you're in the middle of is so quantum beyond comprehension.
I can remember fracturing my neck at Waimea. I went over the falls, I hit the water, and my neck went back in a whiplash and fractured my neck. Lost all feelings of my arms and legs. I was like a seagull, full of oil, just fluttering in the white water, out of control. And some guys came over and helped me in. I'm lucky to be alive, and I think every single big wave surfer could tell you a story like that.
We didn't have flotation devices. We didn't have leashes. We didn't have helicopters waiting to scoop you out. So if you fucked up, you were on your own.
By 1959, Waimea had become the epicenter of big wave surfing, fostering a new crew of big wave talents. Pat Curran, Peter Cole, Ricky Gregg, Fred Van Dyke, Jose Angel, Kealoha Kaeo, and Greg Knoll, whose big wave obsession and even bigger wave personality would forever link him with Waimea Bay.
Waimea was my gal, man. She was like, I surfed with this beautiful woman who allowed me to get away with shit as long as I didn't act too outrageously towards her. There were times when the surf would get perfect, you know, and you go out and catch a wave, just make this thing and just have your adrenaline dripping out of your ears, paddle back out, do it again. You get a little too cocky and you get your ass slapped a little bit, she'd let you know it. But for the most part, there was just this full-on love affair that took place for 25 years, you know.
Nicknamed the Bull for his charging style and clothing himself in a pair of loud jailhouse striped trunks, Knoll emerged as surfing's first big wave celebrity.
He had the perfect big wave persona. He looked like a big wave rider with that big thick neck, and he had the black and white striped trunks, which was genius.
Surfing needed Greg Knoll. When you look at some of those surfers, they were a stoic bunch. Greg Knoll introduced flamboyance to it. He introduced showmanship. He introduced that colorful aspect that most people associated with hot dogging Malibu, not just the way he surfed, but just the spirit of it. He introduced that into big wave riding.
There's a rumble in Brighton tonight.
He wanted to ride the biggest wave that anybody had ever ridden.
Greg made his reputation on taking off on the biggest wave, the heaviest wave.
He stuffed himself into positions that no one else would want. He'd sit over deeper. He'd take off later. He'd spin around at the last minute to go. I mean, he was surfing's like first hellman.
He just liked confrontation. He sought it out in human terms and in big wave terms.
I was really a young, skinny kid, and I got my ass kicked from the time I can remember. I went to school, had my ass kicked. I went to high school, had my ass kicked. And in some ways, maybe there was something there that drove me to want to pursue big wave riding to make some kind of a statement. You know, I'm not a psychologist. I don't know. All I know is once you get into it, there's an adrenaline, a stoke, and that high is so addictive that once you have a taste of it, it's very difficult to not want more.
But for Greg Knoll, big wave surfing became more than just an adrenaline fix. It became his identity, his way of life, and his business.
He was doing it to promote his surfboard business and worked actively to promote himself.
Greg was a good hurdy-gurdy man. He knew how to self-promote himself.
As well as being a successful surf filmmaker, the nickel-and-dime surfboard business Knoll began in his parents' garage had by 1965 become a 20,000-square-foot surfboard factory built around his big wave image.
I had a big building. I had 67 employees. I made 150 boards a week. And for the most part, I was just turning money over because I was selling them so cheap. You know, we were all competing with each other.
And he was a board designer. He was a really influential manufacturer. He was the most complete surfer of the 50s and 60s, by far. No one else could even come close.
Despite the dramatic exploits of Knoll and the other Waimea-based surfers, it was a naive 15-year-old girl from California and her desire to join the Malibu surf set that launched surfing into mainstream America.
Now, honest, surfing is out of this world. You just can't imagine the thrill of shooting the curl. Well, it positively surpasses every living emotion I've ever had.
She acts sort of teenage, just in between age, looks about 4'3".
When you look at surfing's history from the 50s into the 60s, everything has to be perceived as either being pre-Gidget or post-Gidget.
You can't mean...
I'm a surf bum. You know, ride the waves, eat, sleep, not a care in the world.
From the movie Gidget coming out in 59 when there was fewer than 5,000 surfers, to 1963 there was probably 2 million surfers. So in 5 years, it went from 5,000 to 2 or 3 million people doing it.
Following the film release of Gidget, surfing underwent a radical transformation. Surf shops opened doors up and down America's West and East coasts. John Severson's Surfer Magazine began publication. And in 1962, surf music pioneer Dick Dale sold 75,000 copies of his album, Surfer's Choice, in Southern California alone.
Suddenly, surfing was perceived as hip. People assumed that surfers were in the know. Look at the life they were leading. Living on the beach, the sun, the bikinis, that sort of aura of sex, beach blankets, and fires. And then all that golden flesh in the sun.
Hollywood followed Gidget with a medley of surf exploitation films. Then, in 1964, the Hollywood film Ride the Wild Surf turned its lens on Hawaii's big wave surfers challenging Waimea Bay.
Man, I've been hot surf Waimea since I was 13.
Ah, but the question is, can we do it without winding up in traction?
The theme is all the same. There's a bunch of chicks in bikinis wringing their hands that their boyfriend's gonna, you know, go out and risk his life for some big wave, and it's just, man, it just makes me puke.
Man, is he getting creamed?
Well, he's taking gas.
They show the film and a guy sitting there in a fish pond without a ripple.
A big flat out solid.
And then they cut to a, you know, 25 foot wave. Guys are all pouring down the face of the wave. I mean, goddamn, man, who can believe that shit, you know?
Hollywood's always had a misconstrued view of surfing, and so it was more or less offensive to the surfing community.
All these sort of ancillary artistic pursuits that surrounded surfing, they really did all come together in a rush, and all of it happening from 1960 to 1965.
On December 4th, 1969, big wave surfing was hit with what would become known as the greatest swell of the 20th century. A massive low pressure system metastasized into one colossal storm system that consumed the North Pacific Ocean basin, resulting in the largest waves ever recorded. The supersized storm uprooted trees, dislodged boats onto Oahu's Cam Highway, and blew houses right off their foundations. Oahu's 13-mile stretch of stunning world-class surf breaks became a morass of turbulent six-story storm surf.
The first night I was sitting at Waimea looking in disbelief at what I was seeing, that it was breaking so big that Waimea was just a full of white water. So I decided to go around Kaina Point and look at Macaw, because that would be the last spot that would still have some chance of holding up.
Noel set off west to Macaw, the birthplace of modern big wave surfing, thinking the huge swell slamming into the North Shore would be tempered as they wrapped around the island's far western bend. On the drive west, he stopped briefly at Kaina Point to snap this picture, which Surfer magazine later claimed was the largest wave ever photographed.
When we got to Macaw, the cops were going around with their blare horns on their cars, telling people to evacuate the homes on the point.
Macaw was the only big wave break on Oahu considered rideable, as Noel and a handful of daring surfers attempted the huge swells. As the morning progressed, the 100-year swell surging out of the North Pacific was giving rise to bigger and bigger waves.
Finally, everybody was out of the water. I was the only one left, and I was having a real hard time trying to gear myself for this thing, because I knew that basically it was a situation where your chances of surviving one of these waves was about 50-50. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, is it worth giving up the farm for a stupid wave? And I finally had to just paddle outside the lineup 100 yards and sit on my board with my head down and kind of go into another gear. And the final decision was that I would never have forgiven myself if I'd allowed this day to go by with at least trying for a wave.
Noel turned and paddled for what was then considered the biggest wave ever attempted. No photographers were on hand to capture his wave. Not a single shot nor a single frame of footage exists. All that remains are the memories of the handful of surfers who were there that day to witness his momentous ride.
Greg Noel starts to paddle, and we're all in our cars just going, oh my God, look at this. He's starting to paddle into this thing. It's this huge, black, massive wall, and we watch him, and he takes off, stands up, and he's this little speck on this gigantic wall, and you're going, oh my God, and he drops in, and he looks like a little tiny cartoon figure, and he gets that Greg Noel stance where he just gets into the thing, and he goes, I'm going. And he drops down, he gets to the bottom of the wave, and the whole thing's already starting to just come over on top of him. And he just kind of like stepped off the rail. I mean, there was nowhere to go. That was it. The fact that he made the drop, got to the bottom of the wave, and it was like oblivion after that. The whole thing just...
Along with the birth of my sons and my daughter, it was probably the most significant day of my life.
Even though it wasn't photographed, and even though people have argued since then, well, how big really was it? It doesn't matter. In our imaginations, it just was huge. Because on that classic day of the biggest swell ever seen, he essentially rode alone. And he faced it when it came to him. And that's what every surfer does in their own life. Everyone can relate to that.
As Greg Knoll's giant wave broke and vanished, so too did the popularity of traditional big wave surfing at Waimea Bay, as it was broadsided by the late 60s shortboard revolution, where the longer, heavier, big guns were phased out in favor of shorter and more maneuverable surfboards. By the early 70s, the Great Waimea had been usurped by two spectacular, more performance-oriented North Shore breaks, the Bonsai Pipeline, led by surfers like Jerry Lopez, and at Sunset Beach by surfers like Jeff Hackman and Barry Kanayapuni. All this changed in the mid-80s, first with the emergence of Ken Bradshaw and then Mark Fu, two professional big wave riders determined to reintroduce personality and showmanship to the challenge of riding giant Waimea. Then came the Eddie, Quicksilver's big wave riding contest at Waimea Bay, held in memory of the late, great big wave rider, Eddie Aikau. Together, Ken Bradshaw, Mark Fu, and the Eddie wrenched the surfing world's attention back to Waimea Bay, then still considered the Mount Everest of big wave surfing.
Mavericks wasn't supposed to exist. It wasn't supposed to be there.
It was a mystery that it was just suddenly found in this area that's 20-something miles away from San Francisco.
In Half Moon Bay, who's, you know, formerly famous for its annual pumpkin festival. It's as if they've discovered Mount Everest out behind Mount Whitney.
Teenage surfer Jeff Clark grew up along Half Moon Bay's secluded coast, riding homemade boards in the region's powerful, rugged waves, where he carved out a frontier existence, far removed from surfing's mainstream.
I was a freshman in high school, and you could see this place exploding from out behind the building where we'd all congregate in the morning. And I was with my childhood friend, and it's like, I'd go, Brian, we gotta go check that out. We'd sit up on a cliff and watch this place go. And one day it was like, Brian, today's the day. I go, bring your board. And he's like, there's no way I'm paddling a half a mile offshore to a place I've never been. So he sat here at the end of the cliff and said, I'll call the Coast Guard, tell them where I last saw you.
The year was 1975, and the wave Clark intended to ride broke a half a mile offshore into a veritable graveyard of jagged rocks. The wave was considered more a navigational hazard than a surf spot.
I just remember a wave jacking up, I'm in the vein, and total commitment. If I eat it, I eat it, but I'm going. And I hit my feet, and I've never felt water pass across the bottom of a surfboard so fast. Fastest I've ever gone. And I made it. And I just thought, man, I want another one of those.
Jeff Jeff went out there for the first time and rode it by himself and couldn't get anyone to go back out with him.
There just weren't any takers around here. People just didn't believe me. They just thought, you know, oh yeah, he's out of his mind. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I said, it's the best big wave you'll ever surf.
Jeff Clark was sitting out there, nobody in the bleachers, no helicopters flying over, no cheering crowds, doing his shit by himself.
He'd be like the equivalent of a mountain man killing grizzly in the Rockies, you know, and doing a three-day battle and then sleeping inside the carcass that night, not having anyone to tell about it.
My parents had no idea I was riding waves like this. I believed in my ability to go out there and ride it. It was my sanctuary. I could leave the shore and go out there and be so focused and so in tune and feel the ocean with every fiber in my body, and I was part of it.
Jeff Clark's greatest challenge was how he internalized all that emotion and all that drama and all that adrenaline, surfing that place alone year after year after year.
Jeff Clark surfed Mavericks alone for 15 years. Until finally, in 1990, he was able to convince two Santa Cruz surfers, Dave Schmidt and Tom Powers, to join him.
They went back to Santa Cruz with these tales of these waves. And the next time it broke, there were photographers. There were 10 guys.
Suddenly it's like, wait a minute, California is a big wave place.
The discovery of this monstrous wave in Northern California produced an entirely new breed of big wave surfer.
Once Mavericks came about, it was just like right in our backyard.
It really took time to figure out what we had. It wasn't like an instantaneous thing, even though we knew it was heavy and gnarly. It took time for me to really conceptualize what we had.
It was taboo for us to say 20 feet, and it was like 20-foot waves only happen in Hawaii.
The thought was, it can't be as big as Waimea. It can't be as gnarly as Waimea. This can't be as hard as what they're doing there, when in fact it was way harder. It was way more fearsome, and it was way gnarlier.
It's just so gnarly and rocky and just violent and just hateful. It's hateful.
I jumped in the water there, and I had the worst ice cream headache, and within 30 seconds I couldn't feel my hands or feet. How are you supposed to ride 30 to 40 to 50 foot faces? I'm out of here.
You got sharks, you got rocks, you got cold water, you got huge surf.
5 millimeter wetsuits, fog banks that you can't see 2 feet in front of you, oversized boulders from the land of the lost.
They extend across the whole length of where the wave is breaking.
To reach the waves at Mavericks, surfers must paddle over 45 minutes through a maze of rocks, rip currents, and frigid open ocean chop until they finally reach the lineup.
The sacred thing in big wave surfing is, what are the lineups?
Lineups are a means of triangulating your position in the ocean. So you find two reference points on land at about 90 degrees.
Mainly what I use is positioning on hillside. I mean, there's a big mountain behind, and then there's a closer cliff, and they kind of line up. You know, there's a satellite dish you can line up.
You line them up so that you know within a few feet where you are in reference to the reef and the coastline. So if you're just looking at the waves, you don't know if you're in the right spot or not. And it's very, very important to be in the right spot at Mavericks, because if you're too deep, you won't make it.
You're not just sitting there waiting for a wave. The currents are so strong, you're constantly paddling, trying to maintain your position.
The worst thing that can happen out of Mavericks is getting caught inside.
There's sets that come that are on a regular basis, and people get used to that, you know what I mean? And sitting right where those ones are coming. and then a sneak set will just come out of the blue.
It's literally just like in those beach blanket movies. There's nothing happening. You're sitting on your board, and sometimes, corny though it may sound, someone actually yells, "Outside!" And you turn and you go, "Oh, my!"
Your adrenaline's running. Everything is full RPM.
You just want to stroke as hard as you can.
Heart in your throat, paddling as if you're trying to catch a wave, only you're trying to get the heck out of there.
It's just a total survival thing, and nobody really cares about the other guy at that point. You just want to get over it.
Each successive wave will be bigger than the one before.
And you pray that the one that you just barely made it over is going to get you to the next one.
And the next one's just twice as big as the wave you just saw, and it's going to land right on you.
And then, oh man, the sinking feeling. I'm caught. I'm caught. And I'm not going to get away.
Oh, that guy's going to impact, huh? I feel so alone.
There's a point where it gets so critical, you have to either commit and you'll make it out the back, or you slide off your board and swim into a vertical face of water.
You feel like, oh, I made it, and all of a sudden you're just getting sucked back. And the feeling of going over backwards is just horrifying. It's the worst kind of beating.
There's a fiendish pleasure, though, of watching sort of one by one the people that you started with, they get picked off. They don't quite punch through right, and they're gone. Not only is the takeoff the hardest part of big wave surfing, it's the most fun.
It's entirely different than any kind of normal surf because it's basically one burst of energy.
The wave comes out of deep water, but it just stops, and that whole mass of that wave jacks up.
Essentially, the bottom of the wave becomes the top of the wave in a half a second.
It rears up and pulls back and sucks up, and you really kind of have to find your niche where you can be under that.
You thought you were paddling into something that was maybe 20 or 30 feet, and now you're riding something that's 35 or 40 feet tall.
You gotta put everything you have into getting yourself as far down the face as you can before it picks you back up.
You have to basically jump off the cliff right when the thing's about to jump on you.
If you make haste in a takeoff, your odds of you making that wave are very low.
The whole aspect is really more mental than physical. You have to believe you're going to make it.
I know when I'm going to make a wave or I'm not going to make a wave before I even paddle for it.
I have to overcome that safety mechanism that wants to rise up in me and to keep me from doing something that could kill me.
So this fear of the unknown becomes like something you absolutely have to confront because there is no way to turn back your decision.
I'm just wiped out. I'm getting just worked.
Fluttering down the face, getting sucked back over the face, then you basically become the lip.
Flip, front flips, McTwists, every which way underwater real fast over like a football field.
You don't know which direction is up or down or right or left.
It's black, it's dark, I can feel the pressure in my ears.
You're sure that you're near the surface and all of a sudden that what you would perceive to be up is actually the bottom.
And the leash is pulling hard on you. The board is tombstoning up there, and I realized that if there was another wave that was coming, I'm finished.
At one point, it started to stop, and I thought, okay, I'm going to live, you know, and I started to swim up.
And the next wave hit.
And then it just started all over again, just every bit as bad as the first part of it.
I remember feeling underwater, like going over a waterfall underwater. like literally getting sucked into a hole.
Here I am 30 feet down, and now it takes me another 15, 20 feet down. I slam into the bottom down there, and you think, oh my God, I'm deeper than anyone's ever been.
You get to a point when you're down there, like, okay, this is not happening anymore.
No, you got to get to the surface to get air.
Finally, when I come up to the surface, I remember it being so bright. It was like being in a dream, and all of a sudden, back to, okay, this is real, this is live now.
Almost every traumatic thing that can happen to you at Mavericks is due to the leash.
I think leashes are one of the most dangerous thing in the lineup in any surf spot over 20 feet.
There's those few critical situations where leashes become more of a hindrance than a help.
After going down on the first wave of the set, Flea found himself on the wrong end of his leash. When entangled in a crevice, the urethane cord held him in place while he was repeatedly battered by incoming whitewater.
The leash wrapped around the rocks, and just I was stuck for like 8 waves.
How come you couldn't get the leash off your foot?
Because the water current was so strong. It's like doing a sit-up with 200 pounds on your chest.
Flea eventually worked himself loose, but in an even more dramatic incident, Jeff Clark was hurled into Maverick's rocky boneyard and was trapped when his leash became hooked onto Sail Rock.
I can't get the leash off my ankle, and this broken half of my board is dragging me right into the rocks. And finally, I'm getting swirled around, and I got my hands out, and I feel the rock. And I'm hanging onto the side of this rock, and I'm underwater, and the water starts to drain, and I am high and dry. Next thing you know, another wave came over the rock, and I'm underwater again. The tension from my leg rope relieved. I climbed on the rock, and I got rid of that damn anchor that was around my leg.
It's so funny that the Maverick surfers value their surfboards more than their lives.
It's like a lifeline. If you get held down, the only thing that I know is at the end of this is something that floats a lot more than I do. So if I wait and hold on to it, that's up.
So I reach around and grab my leash and climb it back to the top, back to the surface.
And I know for sure that in my personal experience, there were times when if I didn't have a leash, I'm not sure I would have lived.
In May of 1992, 2 years after Clark shared his secret spot with Powers and Schmidt, Surfer Magazine took Mavericks public with a cover story titled Cold Sweat. As if to back up the front page headline, in 1994, California was bombarded by a series of epic north swells, announcing to surfing's big wave fraternity that Mavericks was the real deal.
That's when the entire, you know, surf world kind of converged on Mavericks. It's like, okay, this place is legitimate. We're going to really see what it's worth here.
On December 23rd, the sudden arrival of three of Hawaii's most famous Waimea Bay surfers, Ken Bradshaw, Brock Little, and Mark Fu, created the biggest stir and gave the impression that something momentous was taking place.
That day was amazing. To have the Hawaiians paddling out, Brock Little, Mark Fu, Ken Bradshaw. My gosh, I was like a proud parent or something like that, you know, because they gave the spot that I've surfed for so many years the credibility to actually come and surf it.
Helicopters were hovering and photographers from all the mags were there. And I mean, it was just crazy. We knew it was like the day.
This is one of the best days of surfing I've ever had out there.
Then at approximately 11:20 a.m., during a beautiful medium-sized set, Mark Fu paddled, hopped to his feet, and dropped into his second wave of the day.
went to lunch. I came back out to the point. I saw Brock in the parking lot. And there's this guy, Greg, eerily, have you seen Mark Fu? And that was just...
We were heading back in the boat toward the harbor, and I saw some, kind of looked just like a big clump of something, you know, as we were, you know, passing it, and pointed it out and said, hey, that looks like a body, you know? And, you know, sure enough, we stopped the boat and just realized that it was, you know, Mark Fu. I dove off and grabbed him and just rushed to the harbor. It was a really eerie, you know, experience and just so chilling.
It went from the most pleasant, beautiful plate glass sunshiny day to the clouds moved in. It got dark. The wind came up and it was just, you know, like we lost a great warrior. One of our surfers, one of our own, was gone.
To have that winter when Mark Fu passed away, that was a heavy hit to everybody.
What added to the shock of Fu's death were its circumstances. An innocuous wipeout on a less than death-defying wave in the middle of a crowded lineup.
I just think that he fell on his stomach, knocked the wind out of himself, and was fatigued from the flight the night before, you know?
I think he got caught on the bottom.
The reason I think his leg rope got caught in the rocks is that on the next wave, Brock Little and Mike Parsons wipe out. Parsons comes up, and Brock was behind him. In later interviews, Parsons said, I felt Brock trying to get to the surface. But what he didn't realize at the time, Brock was up. And, it was Fu trying to get to the surface, which kind of confirms that he was being held down by something.
I went and examined his body, actually. There really wasn't any discernible injury. He had a slight scratch on his forehead. His countenance actually was not that of one who had sort of struggled or who had been in anguish.
I felt surfing the Mavericks the years prior to that someone was going to die. I didn't think it was going to be Mark Fu. I thought it would be somebody who didn't know what they were in for.
Mark Fu was this kind of guy who was larger than life to us, you know. A guy who was more invincible than any of us, who had more experience than any of us.
He's the guy that said, hey, to catch the ultimate thrill, you gotta be willing to pay the ultimate price.
Everyone wanted to understand what killed him. That was important, because they were trying to assess the risk in the face of their sudden mortality.
As it sunk in, I didn't think that could happen. Like, I literally didn't think that could happen.
I thought I was invincible. You know, I didn't think I could, I thought I could just huck myself over any ledge and pop back up laughing, you know? And I think a lot of big wave riders have that belief.
When it comes down to it, it's up to me whether I live or die. It's up to me whether I go on a wave or not.
While an extravagant funeral was planned for Fu in Hawaii, surfers from up and down the California coast gathered at Mavericks for a quiet tribute to their fallen comrade.
It turned the clocks back to 10 years before when I'm sitting out there at the peak by myself with my own thoughts.
I wasn't sure I wanted to surf Mavericks after that. So when I went back out there, I wasn't sure if I'd be spooked or not. And I ended up, hey, you know, the wave came to me and it was like, yes. Mavericks said to me, you want to be here. Here's your wave. I caught a great one. Everything was good. It's the way I thought it was. But I always knew that it could kill me, that it can kill anyone.
year to the day after Foo's death, and during a memorial tribute session held in Foo's honor at Waimea Bay, California surfer Donnie Solomon was caught by a closeout set and drowned. Then, in February of 1997, well-known big wave rider Todd Chesser perished in 30-foot surf at a remote North Shore outer reef break. In 1968, in the thick of that era's shortboard revolution, a fatherless, four-year-old boy named Laird Zerfus accompanied his mother Joanne on a chance visit to Hawaii's North Shore. He couldn't have known at the time, but he would grow up to become the greatest big wave rider of his generation. Perhaps the greatest the world has ever known.
After my dad left my mom before I was could even remember, you know, I was in search for a man, a masculine figure in my life, and my mom needed a husband, but I needed a dad.
My friend Greg McGilvery, who was like the father of the IMAX films, he was making a surfing movie at the time, and I was helping him make movies, so I was walking down the beach to see him. And here's this little kid playing around the ocean. So I dove in. I said, "What's your name?" He said, "My name's Laird." I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm body surfing." "You want to body surf?" I said, "Sure." I said, "Why don't you hang on to my neck? We'll body surf."
It was love at first sight with him and I. We had this physical connection instantly.
It was a physical, spiritual, mental. It was like, I love this child thing. It was just, I love this child. And we were just like partners. When we finished, he grabbed my hand. He says, I want you to come up and meet my mom.
I don't know if he had a choice or not. Like, you're coming home with me.
And there was his mother, beautiful, brown-haired, brown-eyed gal. I went, oh my God.
Mom was like, "Oh, who's this?" "No, this is Bill." Like, you know, give him the nudge, you know.
Shortly thereafter, Billy Hamilton, who was known as one of the sport's most popular and stylish surfers, married Joanne, becoming Laird's adopted father and giving him his name.
I was known for, you know, being the kid that like ran around and said, "Hey, my dad's Bill Hamilton. You know who he is?" And they'd be like, then of course, these guys are like guys like Jerry Lopez, like, "Yeah, I know who your dad is. I see him every day." Like, "No, but do you know now it's my dad?" Like, you know, they knew who he was, but now I wanted them to know that he was connected to me. Like, this is my dad. Because if you don't, you might get like a soda can full of sand inside of your head.
The young Hamilton family set about making a life for themselves in Hawaii, where despite the paradisical island setting, the initial years took on a rough edge.
Being a blonde Caucasian, I kind of represented the stereotypical person that destroyed the culture of Hawaii. So a lot of people hated me, wanted to fight with me just because of my skin color.
The way he learned to fight, because he was so big and powerful, was he'd slap an opponent so hard that it would shock them and embarrass them. It wouldn't injure them, but it would hurt them so bad mentally and physically that he just won the fight right at that minute.
After a while, the reputation was there that, you know, you don't want to fuck around with Laird.
So he looked after you as well?
Yeah, of course. I was his brother. He took care of me. I mean, he was the only one giving me beatings. Let's just put it that way. It was a privilege deal.
He wanted to be Hawaiian. He used to dream, he said, of wishing that he had brown skin to be Hawaiian, because for him, that was what was sort of beautiful and strong, because that's what was around him. Couldn't get girlfriends, didn't have a lot of friends. What did he do? He spent and put all that energy into the water.
In the face of this youthful alienation, Laird precociously turned to an older generation for inspiration and camaraderie.
Laird Hamilton was around the legendary big wave riders of the 60s who were moving through into the 70s, his dad being one of them.
During that time period, Pipeline Beach was the mecca of surfing, and anybody who was anybody in surfing came to Pipeline and surfed Pipeline. And so I got to see all the guys.
His dad was making boards for Peter Cole, Warren Harlow, Jose Angel,
the pioneers of big wave surfing. And Laird was just a little sponge soaking all this stuff up.
I aspired to be like these pioneers of big wave riding because they were going out in days when people were evacuating.
Considering his pedigree, a traditional pro surfing career was Laird's for the taking. But from a young age, his imagination was captured by the mythic canvas of riding giant waves.
I was young and impressionable in 1969, so I understood the volume of what was possible. It was like I understood that there was stuff out there that hadn't been tapped and that the ocean was capable of producing places and things that no one had really done.
What Laird and the other big wave riders from as far back as the 50s knew is that lying far beyond the traditional breaks like Waimea were another set of remote offshore reefs capable of producing waves of unimaginable size. Even before 1969, the amazing Third Reef Pipeline broke once in 1963 as a result of a freak storm that awoke the sleeping giant. It took Greg Knoll and Mike Stang 2 hours to make the long paddle out. They waited another 2 hours until Greg finally caught one of the most epic rides in North Shore history. Another ambitious attempt occurred 30 years later in 1993 when North Shore surfer Alec Cook, armed with an 11-foot board, an emergency scuba tank, and a helicopter, had himself dropped in the path of a 6-story swell off Oahu's Kaina Point. He made a valiant effort, actually making the drop on one massive wall before being swallowed. Episodes like this made it clear that when it came to riding giant outer reef waves, traditional paddle and surfing had its limits.
Anytime they talked about the limitations of big wave riding, it wasn't riding the wave, it was catching the wave.
Because as waves increase in size, they also increase in speed. So the bigger the wave, the faster it's moving, the faster you need to be going in order to catch it.
Having already established himself as a dominant force in traditional Hawaiian breaks, Laird Hamilton continued to explore the boundaries of extreme ocean sports, developing into a world-class windsurfer. Powered by the wind, Laird and his fellow sailboarders discovered the speed and mobility necessary to access the outer reefs and sail into waves that were previously impossible to catch by hand.
But then you had this sail, and you weren't really surfing, you were windsurfing, and it was so restrictive that you lost the freedom that surfing had.
I had just done a GQ shoot with Laird, and you know, we both like windsurfing and surfing, and we kind of hit it off, so we started hanging out.
Buzzy and I had been playing around in the Zodiac all summer, doing flat water freeboarding.
Right.
And we were freeboarding in the summer, and then there was a little swell, and we were using swells for ramps, and then all of a sudden we started like taking speed and catching waves, and that's when the light went off one summer day, and then we were like, oh wow, we can catch waves. Wow, we might be able to ride bigger waves.
In December of 1992, Laird Hamilton, along with pro surfer Buzzy Kerbox and legendary North Shore lifeguard and Waimea Bay rider Derek Dorner, launched this surf at Sunset Beach in a 16-foot inflatable Zodiac. Neither of the three could have imagined that by the time they got back to the beach that afternoon, big wave surfing would be changed forever.
wasn't like they were riding waves that were significantly bigger than guys had ridden. It was how they were surfing the wave.
This radical new approach of being whipped into a wave came to be called toe-in surfing.
You get the slingshot from the tow rope, you let go of the rope, and there you are on this beautiful giant wave with no one anywhere near you on this big giant board. There's no crowd there. Bingo.
Progress came quick as the trio swapped the clumsy inflatable for the faster and more agile jet ski.
With the jet ski, you can catch waves all day long and not even get your hair wet.
Back in 1987, North Shore veteran Herbie Fletcher, who for years had been exploring the outer reefs on a jet ski, towed pro surfer Martin Potter into a wave at Second Reef Pipeline. An innovative idea that surprisingly failed to inspire others, until 5 years later, when Hamilton, Kerbox, and Dorner revealed toe-in surfing's true potential.
In traditional big wave surfing, the boards were very large. And the reason for the size of the boards was to catch the wave.
Once you were in, you didn't need a big board. You were fine.
We didn't visualize what actually was going to take place until we went snowboarding. Bing! And if we could ride these giant mountains on this tiny little board, well, why couldn't we do that surfing?
Aided by renowned board builders Dick Brewer, Billy Hamilton, and Jerry Lopez, the trio chopped their boards by 3 feet. Then, drawing inspiration from windsurfing and snowboarding, they strapped themselves to their boards, providing control in the heightened speed and turbulence of riding waves over 30 feet.
The small board was really the big breakthrough. I think that's really where we shifted gears. All of a sudden, now we really had the speed.
The liberation of paddling by motor suddenly opened up big wave surfing's next frontier. Now it seemed that riding any wave, breaking anywhere, at any size, was possible.
Then came the idea of this thing on Maui, where Jerry sat down with Laird and said, I got something you might want to see.
When he understood what we had going, he was like, hey, you know, young man, come over here, I got something to show you.
We had discovered the real unridden realm.
Located on Maui's remote north coast and requiring a long, dangerous approach by sea is Piahi, also known as Jaws. Piahi revealed itself as the big wave of the future. And within its awesome size and power, toe-in surfing came of age.
The biggest difference between this wave and Waimea is this is about 5 Waimeas.
You take Makaha, Waimea, Sunset, Pipeline, Kaena Point, Mavericks, put them all together, mix them in a pot, and that's what you get and more.
Like Waimea and Mavericks, Piahi featured its own crew of groundbreaking pioneers. In addition to Hamilton, Dorner, and Kerbox, were windsurfing champion Dave Kalama. Then Mike Waltz, Pete Cabrina, Mark Angulo, Rush Randall, and Brett Lickle. Known as the Strap Crew, these boys rewrote the rules of big wave surfing by riding giant waves in a manner that was once the realm of sheer fantasy.
things that previously they only dreamed of doing, things we only saw in animation. Suddenly, these surfers were doing it.
Now you're riding waves with greater speed than you ever dreamed of. I mean, it's like a dream. It's just like, oh my God, I'm on a perfect wave. I'm going 35 miles an hour. It's so fun. It's just like, I better shut up.
Coming up on the ski and seeing these plumes of water going 100 feet in the air. And you can kind of hear the drone of the skis in the distance and stuff, and it looks like water world, and you have all these things in your head, like what's going on, what waves are guys riding, what have people done, how bad have wipeouts been so far today, like is anyone dead yet?
The first time I surfed at Peahi, I remember getting so uptight on the way out, just going, oh man, you know, so much anxiety that I was thinking, Jesus, I'm not going to be able to surf. And I remember finally having to go, okay, shit, I guess this is a good day to die.
Challenging waves in the 50 and 60 foot range obliterated the concept of surfing as a solitary pursuit and rewired the rules of engagement.
You got to have eyes in the back of your head, and I got eyes. They're Dave and Derek. They see what I need to see.
I'll just kind of balance right on the crest of the shoulder so that I can see what Laird's doing, and I can also see what's behind us.
It's a three-man operation. Laird and Kalama will be paired up. I'll be in the channel for safety.
Performing as a team is the key to survival in 50-foot-plus waves, where every wipeout becomes life-threatening.
When things go wrong, they go wrong real quick.
You're getting brutalized so severely, you just don't know when it's going to end.
You're an insignificant little rag doll, trying to keep your limbs in so that nothing gets ripped off.
I mean, God almighty, anybody who looks at that shit goes, how can that guy live through that, you know?
The single greatest threat is getting trapped in the impact zone and held underwater as successive 10-story waves explode overhead. Out of sheer necessity of survival, Toen Surfing introduced the Big Wave Rescue, with the ski driver ready and willing to put himself in harm's way to come to the aid of his fallen partner.
I'm thinking about one thing, the next wave that's going to hit him, and how much time I have from where I am to get to him, get him on the ski, and get out of there.
Sometimes you're not going to be able to come in and get him immediately, and he might have to take two or three on the head.
You know, you've got to dash in there, and hopefully the timing's right that the guy's going to pop up just as you're coming by, and you know, you get to get him. Otherwise, you got to get out of there, and the guy's got to take another one on the head. Because, you know, if you lose the ski, then both of you are screwed.
You can rush into a situation where a person is drowning, and then you rush in, now there's two persons drowning.
On a rescue situation where you're really in peril, and it's for real, and it's a real situation, there's that connection. You can see it in the eyes where we need to do this, and we need to do it right now. Nothing else matters. But as soon as that moment passes, it's pure love. It is pure love. Thank you, buddy. I love you. Thank you for getting me out of here.
If one of those guys go down, I will put myself on the line every time. And each one of those guys, they'll put themselves on the line for guys that they don't even know or guys they might not even like. But it's part of their personality. It's part of their nature. It's so when they go home at night, they sleep well because they don't think, well, I should have, I could have, why didn't I? They do it.
When you're underwater and you know, okay, I'm here by myself right now underwater, but
but I know there's somebody up there that's doing everything they can to help me right now. Even if he can't help you, the confidence that's instilled by believing in that person buys you time. It gives you confidence to just make it to the surface.
Really makes survival a whole different story than if you were out there on your own, swimming around in the water, you know, with no one but yourself.
The experiences that you have there, the friendships that are formed going through those experiences are ones that are very deep, because there's times where you call upon or you experience the most deepest sense of who you are. About riding a 60 to 80 foot face wave that draws something out of you. The wave commands so much focus and so much attention that it's the only thing that matters for a few seconds, and it's very purifying because, as far as you're concerned, nothing else exists.
Doing this for your own glory. You're doing this because you're caught up in this great act of nature, you know.
Ironically, the biggest challenge facing these professional big wave riders is not the wave itself.
You can't just go get it on Sunday at 12 o'clock, like you can most anything else.
When the ocean is not making some of the waves available, Laird suffers, like a lot of the other guys do.
Oh, I get so depressed. It's like, oh.
We get frustrated and depressed and bitchy and grouchy, and, you know. Really don't want to be around us when it's like that.
Laird was trying to explain to me what it was like when there was no waves. And he said, you know, it would sort of be like if you were a dragon slayer and there just were no more dragons. And then you wonder, like, who am I and what am I doing here?
And I question that all year long, except when it's 30 feet and I'm out surfing.
King out there. I mean, he was the one that, like Greg at Waimea, you know, dragged the guys out there.
You just watch him surf, and there's no one that comes close to his abilities.
He has the ability to actually slow himself down where everybody else just wants to run like hell.
The reason why I'm able to ride waves the way I ride waves and do what I do is because I have partners like Dave and Derek. I'm only arriving at this level because I'm being driven by these guys to this level.
There's just no question that this guy is the best big wave rider the world's ever seen.
August of 2000, Hamilton took another giant leap by riding a wave so treacherous and so outrageous that it affected the course of big wave surfing history. The wave broke 3,000 miles south of Maui on the French Polynesian island of Tahiti at a reef pass known simply as Chopu.
Thought that a wave could suck so much water off the reef, that a wave could be so powerful and cylindrical.
The wave Laird encountered at Chopu is a freak of hydrodynamics. Unlike the deep water, big wave breaks of Waimea, Mavericks, and Piahi, Chopu explodes laterally onto an extremely shallow, razor-sharp reef. The result is an extraordinary wave that, while not as high as Piahi, is almost unfathomable in its mass, power, and ferocity. Chopu's reputation was already fearsome, but neither Laird nor Derek Dorner could have imagined the once-in-a-lifetime wave that eventually appeared on the horizon.
I towed him onto this wave, and it was to the point where I almost said, "Don't let go of the rope," but when I looked back, he was gone.
I think it's the single heaviest thing I've ever seen in surfing. What could be heavier than that?
Laird's wave at Chopu was the most amazing, single most significant ride in surfing history, more than any other ride, because what it did is it completely restructured collectively our entire perception of what was possible.
You go through a surf magazine, you've seen Pipeline, you've seen Off the Wall, you've seen Waimea, you've seen everything, and none of it has any impact. But when that photo came out, it stopped everyone's heart, and they went, "Where and what is that?"
I remember picking up that magazine, looking at that magazine, and just going, "Man, that shit's impossible. You don't do that."
In my absolute prime, there's absolutely no way I could ride a wave like that.
Normally, surfers are dragging this hand along the face. Laird had to drag his backhand, on the opposite side of his board to keep himself from getting sucked up in that hydraulic. You know, in the middle of that maelstrom, how did his mind say, "This is what I have to do"? No one had ever ridden as Laird rode on that wave before. And so it was the imagination of dealing with that unimaginable energy and coming up with the plan spontaneously. He couldn't practice.
I asked Laird, I said, "Laird, why do you ride waves like this? Why do you risk your life riding waves like this?" And he looked at me. This is a week after he did this. And he was kind of drained from the experience. He was very mellow and very, I think he was humbled by the experience. And he goes, "Dad, I've trained my whole life for this. I don't want to miss an opportunity like that."
I don't want to not live because of my fear of what could happen. It softened some hard corners in my life, I would say. And I felt honored to be awarded with something so magnificent that it just made me appreciate what I've been able to have, experience, do.
Thank you.
One of the things I love about my work as a physician, and I work with cancer patients and people with life-threatening illnesses, is to see what often takes place, which is transformation, literally transformation, where they just begin to sort of eliminate the bullshit, and they begin to actually live, truly live, almost for the first time. And those kind of life-changing events can come from illness, they can come from revelation, they can actually come from, for me anyway, big wave surfing.
That's the thing about it. It's that ultimate big wave that you ride, that you remember for the rest of your life.
They're ingrained in your brain, just like your child being born.
I haven't missed a swell in 55 years. I'm still as excited about surfing as I've ever been. I mean, I literally run to the water with my board hooting and laughing and giggling, you know.
Centuries ago, a young Hawaiian stood up on his surfboard and slid gently across the face of a breaking wave. That same wave has rolled through time, crossing many oceans, bearing the giants of surfing. From King Kamehameha to Duke Kahanamoku. From George Downing to Greg Knoll. From Jeff Clark to Laird Hamilton. Sweeping them all toward that most supreme pleasure, driven on so fast and smoothly by the sea.
French. And my French teacher said, what are you going to do when you get out, when you graduate school? You know, you have to pass this. What are you going to do? You're going to go to college? And I says, no, I'm going to go surfing. I'm going to the North Shore. I'm going to make my pilgrimage to the North Shore. I'm going to ride big waves. And if I don't die, then I'll figure out what I do. This is a noble thing I'm doing. I'm going there to ride big waves, to find out who I am.
The big waves are more fascinating to me than all the other natural wonders in the world. I want to see the biggest swells every year.
Is this a natural wonder as much as, say, the Grand Canyon is?
To me, the Grand Canyon pales compared to, like, Mavericks. I mean, the Grand Canyon is just the sort of erosion gully.
People accuse us of having ego, but it's not all about ego. It's too thrilling to be an egocentric thing.
Sam George, real one.
If you applied the same amount of devotion to a religious pursuit, do you think anyone would call you a religious bum? Probably not. When you consider that surfing really is more than anything else a faith, and devotion to that faith becomes paramount in your life, there's no such thing as a surf bum.
This is the sea, yeah.
And I can tell you at Chopu, I had the little voice going, you should jump off right now. Just jump off. You're not going to make this wave. You should jump off. And on the other side, I'm just going, well, I can't make it unless I just stay on.
What is it inside him that lets him do that?
It was the third testicle we had added at birth. Cut. Roll them.
Action.
But that was the river. But this is the sea. Yeah, 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 yeah.
The main thing is that you need to be able to get rid of the leash if you get wrapped up on the bottom or on somebody else. So we've dealt with it with having a quick release. Before 1994, it wasn't really widely used. After Mark Fu, everybody out there has adapted to this, and we all use leashes, and we all have a quick release.
Even today, when I go over there to Waimea, you know, it just blows me away. It's like, here she is, the same beautiful woman, only now she's snuggling up to the next generation and the next generation. But last time I went, I swear to God, I looked out, man, and I think she winked at me. You know, when one of the big sets came and the sun was dancing off the face of that wave, and the wind was blowing the top off, some guy was streaking, she kind of went, hey, Grigno, I remember you. Makes me almost goddamn cry, and I'm not a very emotional guy, you know.